Welcome to the annual Danilo Husarstruk Memorial Lecture. This is the 13th lucky installment of this series. I find it somewhat incredible that we've been running this series for 13 years. We've had very many, very interesting talks in this series, and I assure you, we're going to have one more today. It's equally difficult for me personally, and I'm sure for many of you, to realize that Danilo has been gone that long. His impact in the Toronto-Ukrainian community, in the world of Ukrainian scholarship, in this university's Slavic department, was very substantial, and many of us remember him very fondly, not only for his very, very many significant accomplishments, but also just as a human being and a very friendly and wonderful fellow. In that regard, I am very grateful to all of you for coming, but in particular, I'm very grateful to the members of his family who have very conscientiously supported this lecture series, both spiritually and physically in their presence. I welcome you. Danilo was a devoted fan of Ukrainian literature, but I suspect that this year, in that great literary afterworld that he inhabits, he is deeply worried and throwing darts at images of me, because our topic this year is one that he probably wouldn't have approved of very much. However, the 13 years of our lecture series have also been years in which Ukrainian literary scholarship is making very considerable progress. And literary scholarship, as I hope you'll all appreciate, cannot limit its concerns only to those couple of things that we really, really, really like. We need to talk about the cultural process that has shaped Ukrainian literature, and that means occasionally looking at things other than what we really want to read. But I trust that after you hear today's talk, you will be inclined, well, maybe not to rush to the library and pick up all the books that are discussed here, but to look at them with fresh eyes and a fresh interpretation. Danilo would be very pleased indeed at that kind of development in Ukrainian literary scholarship, and in the person of today's speaker, Professor Valentina Kharkhun, we have an example and an embodiment of the very positive things that are going on in Ukraine in terms of literary scholarship. To begin with, Valentina Kharkhun is a professor at the Nizhyn University that carries the name of Nizhyn's most famous departure, our dear friend Mykola Gogol, or Nikolai Gogol. And as such, we might be inclined to believe that there can't be anything really important, I won't say really good, happening at a provincial university in a provincial town. And with all respect to Valentina, Nizhyn is a provincial town. But not everything needs to be centralized. And one of the things that we see happening in Ukrainian scholarship is precisely this important decentralization. That is, Ukraine has an academic system where the Minister of Education, may his name forever be unmentionable, controls everything. And the less he controls, even if he turns out to be a wonderful man, woman, and lover of Ukrainian culture, that is, good scholarship happens despite the ministry, no matter who the ministry is. And so what we have in Professor Kharkhun is an example of new young voices, that is, voices from the age of Ukrainian independence, developing programs, developing literary pursuits that reflect a new view of what's going on. And in that unspeakable topic of socialist realism, we have a vivid example of that. That is, looking at things that are, well, to anyone in Ukraine proper, these are phenomena that are well established in the school curriculum and were for years, but looking at them with fresh eyes. Valentina Kharkhun is a specialist in two topics, and her major publications, she has a major monograph on the subject of socialist realism in Ukrainian literature. Its title is «Соцреалістичний канон в українській літературі. Генеза, розвиток, модифікації. Socialist Realist Canon in Ukrainian Literature, Genesis, Development, and Codification». Her other important area of academic interest is the writer Volodymyr Vinnichenko, another new topic both for Ukraine and to a considerable degree for the diaspora as well. And she not only has a monograph on Volodymyr Vinnichenko's works, specifically on Zapskie Kipato Mephistopheles, notebooks of pug-nosed Mephistopheles, but she is also the organizer of a laboratory workshop in Nizhny University devoted to studying the works of Volodymyr Vinnichenko. And she is the editor, she is the promoter, she is the lifeblood of this series and a series of publications. I've got one example that she graciously showed me with me here, Vinnichenko's Nauchi Zoshity, Notebooks of Vinnichenko Studies. What I want to make clear is that this is activity in literary scholarship at the highest level, and what's most important, new initiative, the kind of initiative that we want to see, and the kind of initiative, frankly, that this series was designed to stimulate. I may be talking too long already, so I will turn the floor over to Valentina Kharkhun. Please welcome her warmly.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm really happy to be here today. Thank you very much, Professor Tarnovsky, for invitation, and thank you very much for warm introducing. Thank you very much for coming. At the beginning, I would like to explain the title of my lecture. I'm going to draw your attention to three points. The first one is codification, the main phenomena I'm going to talk about. There are at least two ways of doing that. First is accepted in world historiography, World War II. Second is the Great Patriotic War, elaborated on by Soviet historiography and which reveals the specificity of Soviet perception of historical past. The first codification attests to the research approaches in the interpretation of historical past. The second demonstrates the priorities of an ideological approach. But in the case of my study, it is much more appropriate because for Soviet writers who were Soviet patriots, it was much more the Great Patriotic War. To avoid the contradiction of two terms, I would like to use just term war. The second point is the term depiction. We should remember that in the case of socialist realism, it was rather creation or construction when depiction, especially in the officially sanctioned myth of war. And the third point is the period I have chosen for my lecture. I narrowed down my research to 3 years. It's 1941, 1944, and 1943, the defensive period of Soviet engagement. It was a very special period in Stalinist literature. So I'm going to start my lecture with brief analysis of that period just to clarify the circumstances of the first interpretations of war experience. So war forced substantial changes in Stalinist culture, in literature in particular, which revealed themselves in three tendencies. So the first one focused on the ideological change in the role of literature and its aesthetic categories. A real threat intensified the military strategies of Soviet power, which considered literature as a tool for militarization of Soviet consciousness and as a weapon against the enemies. Here I would like to clarify this statement and to say that the principle of mobilization was the main principle through the history of Soviet culture. But at the beginning, in 1930, it was created in the situation of imaginary and fabricated threats. So the beginning of the war gave this approach, the project of mobilization, real meaning, activating the whole arsenal of motivation in the struggle with enemy. So literature had to anticipate the victory, and it was regarded as its sacred duty. According to this declaration, the main ideological and aesthetic concepts were changed. For example, instead the futurist idea directed toward communism, a new idea, future victory, predominated in literature of war period. The same change was made with the main protagonist of socialist realist literature. He's depicted not as a builder of communism, but rather as a creator of victory. Among genres, poetry took the special place, which can be explained by the specificity of this genre. It could provide a quick response to event and create their image in metaphorical and suggestive forms, provoking immediate reader's response. Among the types of artistic expression, journalistic writing with the predominance of chronicles, factual data, and poster imaginary took special position. So it was the first tendency in socialist realist literature of war period. So here's the second one, which is expanding the canon. This tendency can be found in two characteristics. So the first one is the lifting on restrictions on previously taboo themes and images. For instance, glorious historical past of Ukraine, or Ukraine as a spiritual motherland, or life of a mortal soul, etc. So the second characteristic related to the rehabilitation of imprisoned word, its aesthetic and ontological potential. The credibility of war literature can be explained not just by ideology, but rather the power of fiery words and the sincerity of writers' human feelings toward the fate of their motherland. And the third tendency, which is a process of revision. The circumstances of real threat caused a significant blow to the stability of Soviet myths, especially myth of invincibility of Soviet army. As a result, to use like metaphorical language, cracks appeared in the thinking of Soviet people, and naked truth busted into the literature, causing revisionist narratives as a predominant artistic expression. So we have like three main tendencies: modification, expansion, and revision, which also can be found in the multiple interpretations of military experience. I would like to clarify once again, I'm going to talk about just for three first years of war. So I'm going to discuss three versions of war created by Oleksandr Kornichuk, Pavlo Tychyna, and Oleksandr Dovzhenko. But before that, I would like to represent the main goals of my research. So the first one is the exploration of similarities, differences, or contradictions in artistic interpretation of the war experience. The second one is the study of official codes in military narratives, as well as a revisionist dominance in the creation of war image. And the last one is the analysis of 1941-1943 literature as Soviet propaganda, and at the same time as a true artistic works depicting the real tragedy of war period. So I would like to start with the analysis of Oleksandr Kornichuk's place. So Oleksandr Kornichuk took special place in the Ukrainian socialist realist canon, being the most representative product of totalitarian culture, which the writer selflessly served and which he successfully represented. In a most effective way, a playwright showed his totalitarian talent during the war period, when he was involved in the creation of war myths, demonstrating the priorities of Soviet ideology. I would like to analyze three plays which were written during the war period. So the first one is Partisans in Ukrainian Steppes, The Front, and Mr. Perkins' Mission in the Country of Bolsheviks. As a military writer, Oleksandr Kornichuk made his debut very quickly. In less than 3 months from the beginning of the war, he wrote a comedy, Partisans in Ukrainian Steppes. Taking into account the chronology, it was a time of tragic news from the front. Blockade of Kyiv, heavy battles, the Soviet authorities just starting to develop a strategy for the circumstances of a defensive war. This historical context clarifies the ideological significance of Kornichuk's comedy. It fulfills the functions of rehabilitation and ideologically appropriate information. The function of rehabilitation foresees the rescue of the of Soviet consciousness from the inflicted injury, debunking the myth of invincibility of the Soviet army. Therapeutic semantics in the play were created in several ways. Firstly, Oleksandr Kornichuk used the party's explanation of the army's defeat. Army retreats because, it's quotation, because German fascists unexpectedly hit it like fox. Secondly, the playwright created an image of partisans as defenders who didn't exist in reality, because at this time a decree about the organization of partisans' movements was just being published. This situation attests to the fact that Korniyuk was ahead of reality, or in other words, created the virtual reality of events to come. Instead of chaos, the Soviet army's defeat, which characterized the real circumstances of the beginning of the war, Korniyuk created an image of an organized partisan community winning significant victories away from front line. Thirdly, the playwright depicted the tragedy of situation, loss of harvest, death of people, in comic terms, opposing the tragedy of civilization with people's faked optimism. It should be also noted that Korniyuk employed a therapeutic technique of recognition. He used the plot and imaginative framework of his very popular pre-war comedy, In Ukrainian Steppes. Two family leaders, who were antagonists in the past, became partners in a fight against the enemy, leading a partisans' detachment. This is the plot of the play. The function of ideologically appropriate information foresees the predominance of didactic semantics. In the play, somebody can find answers for main questions raised under war circumstances. Who is who? Korniyuk created an image of hero and enemy. What to do? Korniyuk formulated a recommendation for the organization of partisans' movement. And it is not so good. The tragedy of war muted by humorous scenes. Korniyuk's depiction of war is ideological and mythologized. In the core of Korniyuk's vision of war is the codification of the hero and the enemy. The image of hero is defined by the statement, quote, "Soviet people will never become the slaves of German fascists." The threat of occupation pushed village people to retreat to a swamp where they organized a partisan detachment. Korniyuk described the war as nationwide. Old men, women, and children became the partisans. This approach helped to create generalized image of people who defended their motherland. Portraying this people, the playwright employed exaggerated glorification. Partisans are depicted as a brilliant strategist who skillfully conducted several military operations. Generalization is the main way of the depiction of hero. The principle of individualization can be regarded just as an additional approach in the creating of this image. On the contrary, the image of enemy is based on concretized types. Oleksandr Korniyuk focused on internal enemies of the people. They are nationalists and followers of Petlura, who helped German fascists in exchange for promises of private ownership of land, as well as criminals condemned by Soviet regime who dreamed about the economic restructuring of Ukraine. The second focus in the creation of enemy image is German fascists. Portraying them, Korniyuk used people's expressive codifications, quote, infidels, fascist pigs, beats, damned soul, murders, and cannibals. The playwright also employed the principle of the heroizatia, or debunking of heroic. Germans are greedy, cowardly, and then they want to reach Ukrainian land. The culmination of negative depiction of enemies is their ignominious death. They died not in equal battle, but as captives who are not capable to fight their partisans. Thus, the official version of the war in Korniyuk's play is based on the principle of heroism and debunking of heroic. The writer portrayed the partisans' detachment capable of winning away from the front line and helpless enemy incapable of fighting, who can only accomplish an inglorious death. This virgin of war was quickly spread because Ukrainian theaters played comedy on the Soviet home front and on the battle front. Thanks to play partisans in Ukrainian steps, an ideologically correct vision of war was put into the mass Soviet consciousness. Here is second play, which was written during war period. Oleksandr Kornichuk created another modification of the war myth in the drama The Front, which was written a year later than the comedy in Ukrainian partisans in Ukrainian steppes. The appearance of this drama was influenced by ideological necessity. The playwright was once again trying to explain the reasons of the Soviet army's defeat. The army's retreat continued, raising the question of erroneous action of the party leadership. The Soviet authorities needed to be protected. As a result, propaganda focused on the finding of a fake culprit who was supposed to embody all failures of the Soviet leadership. The drama, entitled The Front, realized this project and was directed at the ideological search for a culprit. The appearance of this drama is associated with a direct order from Stalin. Kornichuk received a vacation and finished the drama in a month. By the author himself, commented on the role of Stalin in different way. When the drama was done, Kornichuk asked the Central Committee of Communist Party for permission to have a drama published, but unexpectedly received it from Stalin himself. Both versions of the circumstances which stimulated the appearance of the play The Front prove that Soviet authorities were interested to have this kind of drama. It is very illuminating that this play, The Front, was published in Pravda, The Truth, the central newspaper of the Communist Party, having the highest percentage of circulation in the Soviet Union. The timing of the drama's publication is also telling. It appeared on August 24th, 1942, which was a crucial moment in Stalingrad battle, when the war itself changed from being defensive to offensive. Both the place and the time of publishing demonstrate that the drama was considered as a very important tool in political propaganda during the war period. The strategic tasks of the play, The Front, foresaw predominance in the pathos of accusation. The author did not use the official version of the war created in his previous play, and which was based on the constructing of hero and image, enemy images. The play, The Front, was focused on the depiction of the highest military leadership on the battlefield, in which Kornichuk searched for the reasons of the Soviet army's defeat. The main conflict of the drama is focused on two military leaders who represented different approaches to war tactics. The panoramic dramatization of the war plan was narrowed down to two heroes. They are both the Soviet, but the first one is recognized as correct and positive, and the second one as incorrect and negative. Thereby, the version of the war is internally ideological. The confrontation between two protagonists is depicted in terms of mythology. Their conflict is the struggle for culture or world order, which in socialist realist vocabulary is considered the crucial words identifying a perfect communist future. The image of General Gorlov is used to represent the idea of uncivilized commander. Gorlov was a hero of the October Revolution, a brave warrior who was awarded a number of medals. in the new circumstances of the war, he's depicted as an uncivilized commander who did not understand the necessity of new military strategies and did not trust the idea of calculation in military tactics. According to Kornichuk, this was the reason for the defeat at the front headed by Gorlov. On the picture, you can see Viktor Dobrovolsky as Gorlov from the performances made by Gnat Yura in 1942 in Ivan Franko Theater. Real Power, whose voice dominates the drama, prefers Ognev, cultural hero who is capable to learn from the experience of modern warfare to grow and move forward. Ognev, contrary to Gorlov's orders, sends a plan of military action to Moscow, which contributes to a successful military operation. The drama The Front has had a huge resonance. Soviet officers wrote a letter to the Central Committee requesting suspension of its publication, deeming it harmful to military discipline. The Soviet authorities reacted immediately. An article about Oleksandr Kornichuk's drama The Front appeared in Pravda in August 29, 1942. The article supported sharp criticism of the backwardness of military leaders, calling for eradication of illiteracy in military strategies. It also emphasized that the image of Gorlov was typical for of Soviet army leadership. The resulting concept, Gorlovshchina, making this the social disease, was elaborated on. So, and the last play I'm going to talk about is Mr. Parkin's Mission in the Country of the Bolsheviks, which appeared in 1943, and it was ideologically and artistically the weakest of Kornichuk's war period plays. The comedy was written as a response to the turning point in the war when the Soviet army stopped the Nazi offensive and the Second Front began. These conditions were the stimulus for the semantics of victory in the comedy. It was aimed at instilling confidence in the inevitable victory over the enemy and a belief in the Allies' support. It is also played a significant role in rehabilitation allegiance in the mass consciousness to its Soviet leaders. To implement this task, Kornichuk used the principle of indirect characteristics. Mr. Parkins, American businessman, visited the Soviet Union to understand its political and cultural peculiarities. The conclusion of this investigation was directed to the postulating of the idea of the greatness of the Soviet country. The weakness of the Soviet people lies in the fact that they have not comprehended what they have done and what they can still do. So on the picture, on the screen you can see picture which was made in Maria Zankovetska Theater. This is the performance Mr. Parkin's Mission in the Country of the Bolsheviks. So to conclude, as we can see, there are three versions of war made in Kornichuk plays. The first one is based on the images of hero and the enemy. The second one, internally ideological conflict of two military leaders. And the third one, glorification of the Soviet country and Soviet authority. All of them made a great contribution to the propaganda of Soviet policy. Here I'm turning to the next part of my presentation, which will be devoted to the analysis of Pavlo Tychyna's Funeral of the Friend. Before my analysis, I would like to mention that we should keep in mind there were at least two Tichinas. So the first one, the author of solo clarinets, the great poet who created his own poetic worldview, and the second one, so-called totalitarian poet. And this poem I'm going to talk about, A Funeral of a Friend, is a unique example where we can find two Tichinas. And this poem is so important for me in today when I'm analyzing the perception of war, because in this poem Tichina tried to rehabilitate of human soul, which was as an image which was under taboo during 1930s. So the peculiarity of Tichina's poem is determined by a focus on the spiritual experience of a lyric protagonist. The three areas of the hero's soul are depicted in the poem. The first one is created by the senses, sight, hearing, taste, etc. The world experience as a tragedy is depicted by acoustic and visual images. The second stage predicts perception in reality in categories. And the third one is connected with affirmation of life. Parts of hero's soul are constructed as coexistence, the tragic with the optimistic. The tragic is depicted in the image of war, unknown soldier's funeral, and an approaching storm. The optimistic is created by the type of protagonist, the narration consisting of declarative and propagandistic discourse, and the plot's elements of Soviet dream about the future. The semantic of tragedy and mourning predominates in the first stage of perception, devoted to the creation of images of landscapes with an emphasis on natural world in waiting of a storm. The image of weeping orchestra played a central role in this level of the hero's perception of the world. Requiem sounds create the appropriate emotional atmosphere for the second state of perception, associated with the process of narrative formation. The lyrical protagonist, Clarence Snow, saw the funeral of an unknown soldier, remembered his dead friend, and this prompted him to join the funeral procession. He returned home and dreamed of a victorious future. Depiction of the funeral scene is the main contribution to the formation of tragic pathos. At the same time, the hero's consciousness is focused on optimistic motives. This contradiction should be regarded, in the one hand, as a vitalism appropriate in the situation of the war, and on the other, as the ideological stimulus. That is why ideological schemes were used to create the pathos of optimism. The first theme associated the exaggerated glorification of France's history, which shown in metaphorical, mythical categories. The second scheme focused on the funeral speaker, who symbolizes the voice of power, and linked the poem to examples of journalistic writing and Soviet propaganda. The third theme, connected with the dream of communist future, uses famous socialist realist cliches, such as the image of land as a natural paradise, the industrial greatness of the country, the hero as warrior, and the Soviet authorities leading it forward. The traces of ideological thinking is in the second stage of perception turn into the main principle of the third stage in the formation of the coexistence of the tragic and the optimistic. As a result, a philosophical conclusion appeared. The tragedy of situation, funeral of unknown soldier, transforms into the tragedy of life, which is depicted in terms of eschatology. Tichina constructed his own eschatological myth aimed at the Soviet Union constitution of political strategies. The main point of the myth is overcoming the chaos and renewing the order embodied in poetic image of history. The myth is also reinforced by the idea of immortality, which sounds as a main motive in the spiritual enlightenment of the hero. This idea appears as a result of sincere human empathy caused by the funeral and the desire to overcome death. At the same time, it is connected with totalitarian ideology directed at improving the spiritual story. To conclude, we should say that two artistic practices have merged in poetic world of Ticino's poem. Synchronization, firstly revealed in solar clarinets, in this poem manifests in a multi-level construction of a poetic world in which visual and acoustic images and semantic of the tragic prevail. Totalitarian dominance is traced to the formation of Soviet eschatological myth, glorification of the heroic and optimistic. The connection of two artistic practices, two discourses, forms the rehabilitative vision of the war as declared in the artistic expression of the poet and the creation of an image of human soul. However, this version of war, close to the official version with its predominance of ideology and propagandistic type of poetic thinking. And here I'm going to analyze the third version of war created by Oleksandr Dovzhenko. The wartime has become the special period in Oleksandr Dovzhenko's literary activities. From the very beginning of the war, the writer actively published his works of art and journalistic writings in central and military and newspapers. Stalin, which is very interesting, approved his tale the night before the fight because Dovzhenko surpassed his order not retreating and embodied it in the tale. So this situation shows that the relationship between the artist and the authority continued to function effectively. However, the traumatic experience of the war had changed the priorities in writers' thinking, programming revisionism as the dominance of his heritage of the war period. On the level of private discourse, it can be found in Dovzhenko's diary, on the level of artistic work in the semantical novel Ukraine in Flames. Focusing on a journalist's style of writing provided a clear author's position with axiological expressive accent and predominated the literary specificity of the novel. Creating the vision of the war in Ukraine, whose population was in different military camps and under occupation, Dovzhenko regarded the war as fair, sacred, and a liberation. In other words, he reproduced the official Soviet codes. They can be found in typical socialist realist scheme, which was reproduced in Kornichuk's plays, for example, which based on clear polarization of hero-enemy, which provides unequivocal semantics of evaluation. The formation of idea of heroism as a dominant theme in Dovzhenko's vision of war is associated with the historical chronology of the war from the time of the Soviet army's retreat to victorious liberation of the Ukrainian lands. The idea of heroism is embodied in generalized images of the Soviet army, partisans' detachment, and is unfolded in individualized protagonists. One of the most important is the image of the Soviet soldier Vasil Kravchino. The protagonist's first representation is focused on twice repeated negative evaluation. I am not a hero. It is predetermined by the tragic time, The soldier retreated with his army, leaving his motherland to the desecration of the enemy. The main point which changed the hero's negative self-evaluation was a night of love with Ukrainian girl Olesya. Here you can see a picture from the film made by Dovzhenko's wife, Yulia Solntseva, in 1967. Dovzhenko's novel was published. So the semantic depth of the love scene reveals at least two interpretations. The first one is personal. This is the union of two people who are trying to overcome their own doom. Quote, "You are unhappy and I am unhappy." And find spiritual closeness, understanding and love. The second semantics of the skin is patriotic. Olesya embodies the idea of motherland which has to be liberated. Thanks to personal, intimate experience, Kravchina gains experience of a nationwide scale. He formulates the basis motivation of why and how he has to fight. As a result, a new self-identification code has been made. Kravchina is symbolically reborn as a hero and warrior. I would like to read, there will be two quotations, and I would like to read it in Ukrainian, and you can see the translation in the screen. Я зрозумів, Олесю, стежка назад до тебе є одна, один є шлях, шлях геройства. Треба бути героєм і ненавидіти ворога. The next step in the creation of the hero image is a test of his new code of identity. The author described in detail Kravchina's spiritual condition during Soviet Army's retreat. The routine of war opened up the drama of situation for the hero. Poverty of human soul, the cruelty and short-sightedness. The right to be a hero Kravchina gains with blood. Dovzhenko depicted the cinematic mosaic of scenes informing many of Kravchina's injuries and his medical treatment. Next time, Vasyl Kravchina appears as a military commander, a brave warrior, and a wise mentor enriched by the experience of war that went on the offensive. Another dominant clue in the heroic code was established: victory and magnificence. Turning to his subordinate, Kravchina says, «Невже ж ти, проливши кров свою, так не зрозумів нічого, хто і що ми не обивателі, не свідки історії ми, а герої великого грізного часу, що не наживем ні капіталів, ні земель чужих не завоюєм, ні людей не підкорим, що прийдемо додому на пожарища, руїни, так що декому ніде буде і голову приклонити». Ні батька, ні матері, ні брата. І скажемо, ми перемогли. І це буде велика наша горда правда на множество століть. Кравчина's ability to formulate the truth, to produce an appropriate vision of the war, is considered by Dovzhenko as a perfect heroism. The hero is portrayed among a group of people, liberated peasants and soldiers, during confidential conversation and is deemed to be a spiritual authority. The poetics of heroism created in the image of Vasyl Kravchina, Dovzhenko unfolds in a broader plane as a history of the formation of an invincible Soviet army. At the beginning of the novel, Dovzhenko concentrated on the depiction of retreating soldiers in a situation of disorientation, lack of directions, and confusion. The main type of soldier in this time is the heroic marcher who gives his life trying to stop the enemy's occupation. The writer concentrates on searching for the factor which turns soldiers from sufferers in the war into winners of this war, creating a clear motivation, formulating of a valuable orientations, create the basic military principles of mass consciousness and signal the birth of a holistic, combat-ready, and perfect military team, winners of the war. The monumental image of soldiers is completed by a depiction of partisan detachment. Oleksandr Dovzhenko used the style of the Ukrainian heroic songs to represent the image of partisans. They are depicted as tireless folk heroes releasing their native land from enemies. Cossack semantics is a crucial approach to the depiction of partisan. He has the family name of the main protagonist, Zaporozhtsi. The image of Lavrin Zaporozhets is central to the representation of partisans. He is portrayed as a father in its direct meaning, as head of a large family, in the past the chairman of a collective farm, and symbolically personifying wisdom and the spiritual grandeur of the invincible Ukrainian people. Lavrin Zaporozhets is a skilled strategist in the fight with the enemies. Forced to accept the post of village major under German occupation, he holds a dual policy: demonstrate your loyalty to the German authorities and at the same time undermine their rule. After he joined the partisans' detachment, Lavrin became its successful leader. So, analysis of Dovzhenko's vision of the heroic in depicting the Soviet army and partisan detachment leads to the conclusion that its specificity can be explained by the union of Soviet ideological text with folklore. This union turns into an attempt to link the official myth of the war to Ukrainian historic and philosophical ideas. In the context of Dovzhenko's novel, it is seen in the end when the partisan detachment meets with Soviet soldiers. Besides the hero image, Dovzhenko's bipolar myth of the war is based on depiction of the enemy image. The main function of this image is to underline and to highlight sanctity and righteousness of the hero. The enemy image is focused on Germans, the Italian alias, Kurkus, and nationalists as the traitors of the people. The latter are not depicted, but their shadow is cast in the novel by Krista's sentence in particular. She is recognized as a nationalist. This approach demonstrates a clear differentiation between our own and allied Ukrainians, revealing unfortunately Soviet codes of Dovzhenko's text. Soviet codes also influenced Dovzhenko's vision of Europe as an enemy. The main thrust of the enemy depiction is focused on the Germans, the representation of which is quite broad. Occupier, invader, Nazi, Hitler soldier, fascist, SS man. The specific of construction on the enemy image is subject to a definitive assessment by the author. Despising and denouncing the enemy, Dovzhenko rhetorically, with intransigent pathos, debunks and annihilates him. It is illuminating that Dovzhenko does not differentiate in his estimation between the German army and German people, generalizing his depiction of the enemy, bestowing negative characteristic on it and imposing a sentence on all German people. Dovzhenko's position convincingly demonstrates the infection of his artistic thinking by ideology. It is well known that during the 1920s, Dovzhenko lived in Germany, served as a consular secretary to the trade mission of the Ukrainian Soviet Republic, and attended lecture at the Berlin High Academic School of Fine Arts. The writer's biography shows that he knew German culture and everyday life of German people quite well. But his depiction of Germans was subordinated to ideological expediency, sacrificing artistic truth. The writer created myth of a faithless enemy based on a distortion of reality, grotesque imagery and exaggeration. His knowledge of German culture, Dovzhenko reveals here only at the level of linguistics, allowing Germans to express themselves in their native language. Contrasting the generalized image of Germans as occupier, focusing on rhetorical humiliation of the enemy, Dovzhenko uses the formula of human stomach, demonstrating an elementary vitality. The writer depicts drinking and working Germans fulfilling their needs, killed, destroyed, and raped. Germans are depicted as uneducated. The logic of their behavior is explained by mechanical execution of orders. The main motive for their participation in the war is economic benefits. Nazi authorities promised them hectares of rich Ukrainian land. And here you can see a picture from a Yulia Solontseva film, which demonstrates enemies who want to grab rich Ukrainian land. The apogee in the scornful depiction of the enemy is his inglorious death. The enemy is annihilated, not a courageous warrior, but as a criminal. Dovzhenko focuses readers' attention on the following scene. Bees stinging German soldiers to death, cowardly behavior of soldiers who captured by partisans, a dead German soldier whose mouth is stuffed by Ukrainian earth. The most striking example is related to Colonel von Krause, who serves as a crucial figure in the construction of the enemy image. Coached by partisans, he died humiliated. He is condemned as a criminal. It is very illuminating that Dovzhenko did not depict his death. He just disappeared. So, the official text of Dovzhenko's myth is therefore intensified by creating of cheering pathos for heroes and pejorative pathos for the enemy. Biblia of pathos is motivated by ideological expediency, as well as Dovzhenko's sincere human empathy. Being a Soviet patriot, he activated the entire arsenal of romantic poetry for creation of the official vision of the war. But this vision does not cover the whole semantic potential of the author's myth of the war. The catastrophe of civilization predetermines the necessity of an opposing view. Tragic reality forced perception of war as suffering, undermining the official vision of the war. Using expressionist aesthetics, Dovzhenko depicts the terrifying reality of war, devastated land, human sacrifices, and broken lives. The threat of differentiation in society becomes the biggest shock for the writer. Instead of depicting a monolithic Soviet people, united by the idea to overcome a hated enemy, Dovzhenko portrays the fragmentation of society into wartime categories: refugees, the occupied, deserters, Nazi policemen, and prisoners. This dissolution destroyed a uniqueness in images of hero and enemy. The writer depicts the dysfunction in communication between members of the Soviet community when refugees hate those who are willing to remain in the occupation, while the occupied people condemned refugees fleeing their land. Dovzhenko tries to understand the cause of this social catastrophe, closely related to the Soviet defeat in the first years of the war. Analysis of the realities of the war led Dovzhenko to a dramatic conclusion. The cause of catastrophe is in the strain of the Soviet consciousness, which was formed as a result of ill-convinced policies of the Soviet state. The first time this analysis is expressed through the voice of the German Colonel von Krause, who knows the history and psychology of the Ukrainian people and skillfully uses this knowledge in the development of military strategies. This approach to the creating of an enemy image conflicts with Dovzhenko's personally created myth of enemies as thick-headed geeks. Krauss admires the vitality of Ukrainians and their ability to die, but at the same time draws attention to their shortcomings. Ці люди абсолютно позбавлені вміння прощати один одному незгоди, навіть в ім'я інтересів загальних, високих. У них немає державного інстинкту, вони не вивчають історії. Дивовижно, вони вже 25 літ живуть негативними лозунгами відкидання Бога, власності, сім'ї, дружби. У них від слова «нація» залишився тільки прикметник. У них немає великих істин, тому серед них – так багато зрадників. It is evident that the Soviet enemy, German Colonel von Krause, formulated the social diagnosis of the Soviet society: ignorance of history, loss of ideological orientation, and corrosion of moral values. The same diagnosis is repeated in the author's commentaries and his protagonist speeches, turning into the key motivation for his creative thinking. The myth of the war unfolds in a revision of the entire Soviet society. Taking into account the close nature of the Soviet cultural myths, the measure of revision is very impressive. Dovzhenko criticized the party's dogmas and their implementation. He pointed out the difference between the highest ideas of the program and spiritual impoverishment of the Soviet people, the postulating on the strained party lines and the apathy to the fate of particular individual. The logic of Dovzhenko's revision foresees not only a critical reflection, but also the constructing of an implicit program of rehabilitation for society. Using metaphorical language, the writer takes the position of a social physician. He believes that there were circumstances mobilizing society's internal potential, contributing to catharsis, release the spiritual waste and cynicism. Hence, a strategy is announced by the principal positive hero. Every one of us has to have two victories. Victory are the fascist occupy and national common great victory, and the second, small victory over numerous personal shortcomings, rudeness and stupidity. Dovzhenko based his rehabilitation program on two approaches. The first one is situational and associated with stabilization, social consciousness, and consolidation of the society. The writer offers a clear code of emotional impulses that stimulate spiritual purification. The enemy can have only hate and revenge, countrymen, compassion, understanding, and forgiveness. The second approach is perspective. It focuses on the intensification of the archetypal categories of Ukrainian mentality: family, nation, and homeland. Dovzhenko speaks of their priority numerous times, practically treating Ukrainian consciousness. Dovzhenko depicts members of the Zaporozhets family fighting with the enemy on different fronts, making significant contribution to the victory. Portraying the Zaporozhets family, the writer points to the idea of an invincibility in the family. Family is a part of larger community of people whose life is based on the unity of generations. One of the last scenes in the novel is very symbolic. Soviet soldiers rest in the cemetery. There they feel deep connection with their own past. Dovzhenko insisted that the immortality of people rests in this connection. That is why the author often refers to the archetypal vision of the war as a confrontation of immortal people and deadly enemies. Dovzhenko believed that success in this confrontation is stimulated by the idea of the motherland. At the same time, he argued that Soviet Ukrainians lost the idea of motherland, which caused their defeat in the beginning of the war. To compensate for this loss, the writer reconstructed the image of Ukraine as a spiritual motherland, which can be regarded as the core of Dovzhenko's worldview. So, to conclude, I would like to say that Dovzhenko's own myth of war is based on two texts. The first one is official. It postulates the probable, desired, and ideologically motivated perception. The second is revisionist, appearing as a result of Dovzhenko's deep analysis of the war circumstances. The predictability of critical reflections, their depth and emotional conviction, predetermined the prioritization of his revisionist view of the war and the corresponding reading of the novel. As we know, Ukraine in Flames was sharply condemned by the Soviet authorities, Stalin in particular. This reaction can be explained by its attack on the socialist realist canon. Because the writer used the text of his novel not just to reproduce an ideological scheme, but to criticize a social strain and to promote his own view of how to overcome social disharmony. Dovzhenko's novel was banned and the film was not created. However, the novel was published in the mid-1960s and played a significant role in the deconstruction of the Soviet realist canon, postulating, instead of the dominant romantic and celebratory view of the war, a critical and tragic version of the war. Here I would like to stop and to say, if you would like to know just a little bit more about the interpretation of war experience or about socialist realism in Ukrainian literature, I would like to recommend read my monograph, and unfortunately written in Ukrainian, so you can find maybe, I hope so, a lot of answers for your questions. And if you have questions, I can be reached by emails. Thank you very much for your attention and for your patience, and I'm looking forward to for your comments and questions. Thank you very much. I want to